Just a quick announcement before tonight's show. Somehow I've been completely locked out of my Forbidden Knowledge News Facebook page. Most of my daily news updates go up on that page and I can no longer access it. I had to make a completely new page. So if you follow me on Facebook, please click the link I put in the description to the new Facebook page. Thank you and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight I want to welcome Jim Penniston. He is a United States Air Force Security Forces retired, serving over 20 years active duty. He was assigned to the Strategic Air Command Elite Guard in Omaha, Nebraska, providing security for general officers, congressmen, foreign heads of state, the president, and members of his cabinet. He held key assignments throughout the world, including service in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He wrote defense security, counterterrorism, and contingency plans for the United States Air Force and NATO. Additionally, he provided security support for Air Force One and other classified aircraft weapon systems. He is also the co-author of the Rendlesham Enigma. Jim, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Chris. That you got through that part of it. Without getting tongue-tied. I thought you'd get tongue-tied at some of that.
Almost, a little bit. But yeah, I got through it pretty good. And thank you so much for joining us. I've been looking forward to this because your story has become one of the most compelling and fascinating accounts, I believe, in the history of ufology. The Rendlesham Forest incident of 1980, and you experienced this firsthand. This fascinating encounter. We get to hear all about it tonight. So I know you've told this story probably hundreds, maybe thousands of times, but it's such a fascinating story, and I'm sure there's plenty of my audience that hasn't even heard it yet. So take us through that night in Rendlesham Forest, 1980. What happened?
Okay, let me set it up just a little bit where it's at. It was 1980. I arrived there in July of 80, and this is December 1980. Matter of fact, it was December 26. And it was twin bases. It fell under the operational control of RAF Bentwaters. The twin bases were separated by 3 miles, which was Rendlesham Forest in between them. And it was located about 60 miles, I would say, northeast of London. So it sat right on the coastline of the North Sea, maybe about 4 or 5 miles in. It was the height of the Cold War. We had a different type of terrorism, Baader-Meinhof, Black September, the RA, things like that. They're all history now. And a different type of terrorism. We also were under threat of Russian or Soviet type observance, and that they were constantly testing our ability in that. So it was pretty intense time. Bentwaters and Woodbridge also had under its control two C-3 facilities, which is communications. One was at Marstrom Heath, a couple miles away. Another was at Broadsea, which was not too far away, maybe 4 or 5 miles. We had 4 forward operating locations in Germany in case of war. We had 6 squadrons of A-10, and their job was during the event of, a war with the Soviets. Back in those days, they would have took 5,000 tanks, crossed the Rhine, and those A-10s are noted for being tank killers. And they would have went to the forward operating locations and, hopefully destroyed 5,000 tanks. The base had a total of 10,000 people. Of that, about 7,000 were active duty. The rest were dependents. That sets up where it's at and what we did. My job that night was a night like every other night I've worked. We were working 12-hour shifts. Law enforcement, which is a separate entity, was working 8-hour shifts. And I had just posted my guys at RAF Woodbridge, and Sergeant McCulley, the START leader, the security response team leader, was posting them in the restricted areas and stuff around there. I was doing my checklists. I was running, you know, like simple mundane things like lighting checks for the perimeter, things like that. Anyway, we completed all them. And Sergeant McCulley got with me and says, you know, how about, you know, doing morning breakfast? So I headed to the chow hall around midnight and to meet Sergeant McCulley. After arriving there, you know, I had just poured a cup of coffee and Sergeant McCulley said, "Do you hear the radio?" And I said, "No, I didn't hear it." He says, "They're trying to get a hold of you at Central Security Control." And I said, "Okay." And so we have a direct line from the dining facility at Woodbridge to Central Security Control at Bentwaters. So I go over and pick up the phone and Sergeant Coffey, the senior controller, answers. And I said, "What's going on, Dave?" And he says, "You need to get out to East Gate. We have a situation out there." I said, "Okay." I said, what's going on?" He said, "Two law enforcement patrols will brief you when you get there." I said, "Okay." And he says, "And run code 2. And I said, "Code 2 with lights on?" He goes, "Yeah." I says, "Is there something, you know, wrong out there?" He goes, "No." He says, "They'll brief you when they get there." He says, "You're in no danger." I said, "Okay." So I headed out there, and it's, you know, going 45 miles an hour. It takes a couple minutes to get to the East Gate from the chow hall. I arrive. The first person I see is Sergeant, oh boy, what's his name? Sergeant Steffens, Bud Steffens. And I said, "What's going on, Bud?" And he points over to the Reynolds Forest area. And I looked over, and you can see where the tree line was. You can see a bubble of light over the top of the forest canopy. And then in the forest itself, you see multicolor lights flashing in and out. And at that point in time, I've probably been to, you know, 20, 21, 22 aircraft crashes, quite a few. And I says, "Did you see a crash?" And he goes, "No," he says, "it didn't crash, it landed." I said, "Well, what do you think it was? A chopper?" And he goes, "No." He says, "I don't know what it was." And the thing was, Rendlesham, the Forestry Service plants those trees, and like every 10 years, they'll cut them down and then replant them. And those trees are all about 5 to 6 feet apart. So there's no way anything could land inside the forest, okay? It just is not possible. So I went over to the direct line at the East Gate. Had law enforcement desk patch me through the security control. And I said, "Yeah, I'm observing, you know, lights in the woods." I said, "Has a dome of light over the top of the forest canopy." I was going into detail like that. And when I called Central Security Control, when they pick up the line, there's like 5 people on the line at one time. I mean, there's like the shift commander, the flight sergeant for Bentwaters, security controller, the comm plotter, okay? There's just a lot of people because everybody's going to be doing different things, depending on what I say. And while I was talking to the flight lieutenant about it, and I says, "Well, I don't hear any noise." I says, "But it appears to be a fire." I said, "Possible aircraft downing." Even though it didn't seem like one, it was the only thing I could rationalize at the time. And about 15 seconds later, Sergeant Coffey comes back online. He was in contact with London Heathrow radar and also Broadsea and I guess Bentwaters radar. And apparently they had lost, according to him, has lost contact with a craft about 15 minutes prior to me calling the control center over the Woodbridge base. So that was a probability that was an aircraft crash. And since there was no transponder on it, we figured it was military because Heathrow couldn't track it right. I mean, they didn't know what it was. All they knew had on their screens was blips. And at that point in time, because of the status of forces agreements with the British, we had to have an emergency situation off base to deploy as part of our agreement with the British. And Lieutenant England, the shift commander, had gotten a hold of the wing command post, and through them got a hold of the base commander, Colonel Conrad, and got permission for us to deploy off base. And so I took myself and two airmen. One was a law enforcement airman, and the other one was a security airman. And I had a radio, the security airman had a radio. And what my job was going to be is to go off base, set up an entry control point that we could use as emergency entry for responding forces and or first responders, like fire department, you know, and stuff like that. And so I had the crash kit inside the Jeep, and I pulled out the plotting board so I could plot where the enter control point was going to go. And I pulled out some binoculars and a camera. And we used the camera for other things besides the crash kit. We used them for people. We observed them on the perimeter, taking pictures of us. We took pictures of them, things like that. And so we started to deploy without weapons off base. And like I said, the Forestry Service cuts these like a crop, the forest, every 10 years or so. And they do sections of it. So at that time, it had been cut maybe for 100, 150, 200 yards. It was all clear field. But they had berms of earth. That's where the tree plantings usually went. So I went down a logging road as far as I could go without tipping over the Jeep. And I figured this is as far as I can go at one point. And it was maybe, you know, 50 to 75 yards from the tree line. And I could still see multiple color lights in the forest, but mostly it was becoming more of a dull white light coming out of it. All of these things are things not inherent with aircraft crashes, by the way. There was no smell of fuel. There was no nothing burning, nothing like that. So I was perplexed at, you know, from that point to setting up the entry control point. I set up Airman Kabanzak. He was the security airman, and he was the one with the radio. I had one, he did. And I was also having problems. He was going to be the entry controller. He would help, you know, the responding forces go through that area. They usually probably put their vehicles up that far and probably have to walk in like I was going to do. And I was also getting a radio difficulty with the control center. I couldn't hear them properly. So what I did is I said that Kabanzak was going to be set up as a radio relay. He could relay between him and Sergeant Chandler, who was the flight sergeant from Bellwars, had arrived at that time at the East Gate, took my position over. And I said, you go ahead and relay my messages to Sergeant Chandler, and he'll relay them to the control center. Which was really unusual because the twin bases at that time, we had repeating systems all over the base, radio repeaters. There's no way you'd get a dead spot, okay? Anyway, myself and the law enforcement airman started toward the tree line at Rendlesham. And, you know, as we're getting closer, all I could see, no color. It was just now a white, dull light coming out of the forest. And as we, you know, as I approached it, you know, I was starting to, you know, feel, you know, tingling, like static electricity on my skin, on my face, my hair, clothing.
Right.
And I did have my camera from the crash kit, so I was just like flipping, you know, taking pictures. We had roll film at the time, 35 millimeter. So I'm snapping away because this doesn't look like an aircraft crash. And the other thing, we weren't armed because we thought it was going to be a response, you know, for the crash. As I got to the perimeter of the forest, I found as I entered it, there was a more physical effects happening. First of all, it was dead silence. There was no noise at all. Then on top of that, I found that as I was coming toward the berm that was sort of in front of this white light, my movements became labored. The best way to describe that would be walking waist deep through a pool of water. I was actually labored trying to walk. It's no longer an aircraft crash. I call in, even though I can't receive, I'm still calling in on the radio. And so I terminated the security response option for a aircraft crash. And I initiated a helping hand situation, which is a possible hostile threat to the priority A, B, or C resources at the twin bases. Because I knew it wasn't a crash. And as I started toward the burner, there was a flash of light. I mean, a huge flash of light, white light. So I hit the ground. The airman with me, who was back 25 feet to my right rear, he hit the ground. And, you know, then I got up because I guess it was a reactionary because there was no explosion. I was expecting that's what was happening. And so it was just a flash of light. And then the flash of light started to get dimmer. Back to my left was about 75 feet was Airman Kabanzak. He was where I set him up for the anchor control point. The other thing I noticed as I came up toward the berm is now I can walk better. My feeling of labored movements is not as strong. But there was a really strange, I mean, I'm about maybe 10 feet from going over this earthen berm. And what was really strange is it was like I was in a bubble, like around this craft and that, which would be the craft. I didn't see it yet. And that 15, 20 feet was right around me. It seemed like a bubble of meaning that the light from the craft was, you could see it on, you know, the sides and top of, you know, above me. And then on the outside of it, I seen there was the law enforcement airman. He was back there to the right. He was just standing there motionless, standing up. And I looked back to the Kabanzak, and he wasn't moving either. So I continued to make my security checks with the radio, even though I wasn't getting anything back. And as I went over the berm.
You said they were just standing there? They weren't moving?
No, they weren't. I don't know if they were scared to death. I don't know what was going on.
Oh, okay. Okay, continue.
I have no idea. They were just motionless. But it could have been the effect of this area that I was in immediately around, you know, this object.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. But as I came over the berm, this white, bright light was started to dim down. I mean, it was dissipating. And it started to dissipate to the point where I could see a structured craft, a triangular craft. And eventually just dissipated right down to where all I seen was a black craft with, excuse me, globular lights running through the fabric of the skin of the craft. They were red and blue and green, and they're just different colors, yellow. And they were moving quite fast through the craft. And eventually, the only white light that was coming out of the craft was at the bottom of the craft. And I'm out of pictures, film at that point in time. It wouldn't have made no difference anyway, but I was out of film. And then the globular lighting started to slow, and then it just dissipated through the craft, and it was nothing there but a black craft, triangular in shape.
And it was it like a matte black or a metallic shiny black?
The best way to describe it is it would be like black glass. Okay. So if you had black glass, you'd have, you had some reflection out of it, off it. Okay.
Right.
But still I had this white light coming out from underneath the craft. So, I don't have too many options right now. I don't know whether or not that this is hostile or it's going to, who knows? I didn't know. Had a lot of things running through my mind.
How large was this again?
Well, what I did is I tried to investigate as best I could. I had no measuring stuff, so I had to do what I had to use what I had. And what I did is I paced it off. Three large paces is 9 feet. It stood about 6.5-7 feet high because I'm 6'2". I'm guessing. I'm making estimates here. And I was fascinated because all it's there is this black craft now, and it has a large dorsal fin coming up out of the back, like our aircraft have, something like that. And so I'm wondering how it's fixed to the ground. So I look underneath it, and you know, all I see is this white light coming down, but I can see the indentions in the ground. There's three of them, but all is light. And I'm using the word light because that's the only way I know how to explain this technology. Obviously it's not light. And so I'm saying somehow this is being supported by this light. So I pushed on the craft to see if it would move. And if it was a car out there, you could actually move a car. It would move an inch or two if you're pushing right on it. Yeah. And this is solid. It did not move at all. So perplexed. So I started to take notes, started writing down part of my investigations. Like I said, I paced off the craft. So I measured, you know, equilaterally, 9 feet on each side, and then about 6.5-7 feet high. The air temperature at that time, that night, was, I find this out later, by the way, was 32, 33 degrees. That's where it was hovering around. But the craft was warm to touch. Later I find out it's probably because of the beta radiation. we find that out later from the investigation team in the morning, but.
And it didn't appear to have any type of like propulsion systems or anything like that.
Well, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for things that make, that allow aircraft to fly. I looked for flaps. I looked for aerons. I looked for, crew compartments. I looked for openings. I looked for anything, intakes. I looked for exhaust. It was void of all those things. It was just a completely molded, solid craft. I mean, there wasn't even riveting. It was that smooth. So as I did my 360 walk around, on this, you know, and taking my notes, I come back around the far side of it, and I see some type of writing on it, and I go, oh, well, that's hopeful, you know, probably say NASA or U.S. Air Force or, you know, Soviet or something, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because I got a lot of doubts going on what it is. And because I'll tell you what, up to that point when I was off it, part of my work with, you know, besides being, you know, bodyguards for generals and stuff like that, we also did security for classified briefings for research and development, things like that. And I've seen what was, you know, on the planning for the next 50 years for aircraft, you know, and this is nothing like what I was, you know, was sitting in front of me.
Now, did you believe in UFOs before this incident?
No, I didn't think too much of people that thought about that, you know, that believes in that stuff. I just thought it was, you know, they're crazy. Anybody believe in that stuff? So the answer is no.
Right.
I left the woods thinking something totally different, though. So.
So you were making your walk around the craft.
Yes, and anyway. So I get closer, and I see that they're not writing and stuff. It's sort of like glyphs or symbols on the side of the craft. And, you know, I stretch my arms out, you know, so it was about these. There's like the main part of the symbols were on the bottom, and there was on top, there was a triangle one with a circle around it. And the ones on the bottom, they measured about five inches high. That's how big they were. I'm using my hand to figure that out. They were about three and a half feet long on the bottom. And there was this one on of course, the top, the triangular one. And that was bigger than the rest of them, by the way. It was more like a pie plate. And then I started back around, recorded them, did another 360 walk around because I am going from no longer scared to in awe of what's in front of me. And it looks like it's somewhat safe because I'm still there. And so the anxiety was going down just a little bit. I went back around and I was fascinated by the glyphs themselves. So I was feeling the, you know, the fabric, the craft, which is just glass like smooth, but it was metal. Okay, there's no doubt it was some kind of metal, but it wasn't glass, it just felt that way. And so the first bottom symbol I felt was went from that smoothness to the glyph was like from black glass to sandpaper. Okay, so it was like it was etched in the craft. So I was feeling the bottom symbols. But the one that fascinated me was the bigger one that was on top of them. It was the triangular one with the big circle around it and the two smaller or the three smaller circles on it. And so I touched that out of curiosity. And there was a brilliant, for lack of better words, bright white light, so bright I couldn't see anything else. And I see nothing but then symbols like ones and zeros, ones and zeros, ones and zeros. And but there still is no sound or anything going on, and I gained my senses. I don't know how long I had my hand on there, but it wasn't long. And I gained my senses. I just lifted my hand off and immediately stopped. Everything was back to normal, as normal as could be, I guess. And the reason I say that it wasn't light per se, because that forest is black. I mean, it's so dark out there, except for the light that was coming out from underneath the craft. It was just pitch black. And I immediately had my night vision after I took my hand off. So it was not light, because that would have took 45 minutes or 30 minutes at minimum to get that back. But it was some type of technology I didn't understand. I still don't understand it. So I went around and I didn't touch the craft after that. That was the last time. I kept my hands off it. But then as I went back around, it started to have these gobbler lights started appearing inside the craft skin again. And they started moving. So I got about 10, 15 feet away and I got on the ground because I thought I activated some by touching it.
Right.
Or maybe it was going to explode. I didn't know what it was going to do. And so I got down on the ground, and there was no explosion. It lifted off the ground, maybe 4 or 5 feet, and then it moved back to the trees. Remember, the trees are only 5 to 6 feet apart, and the craft is 9 feet because I just paced it off, moved back through the trees.
Did it just like maneuver through the trees?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know how it did it.
Did the craft appear to have any occupants?
No, it's too small for that. It was definitely too small for that. I looked for crew compartments and stuff like that. And that was before the days of such things as drones or anything like that. I mean, we didn't have those things. But I assumed it was unmanned until it started moving, which it was under intelligent control, obviously, because moved back, then lifted it up, to the canopy of the trees, made a slight right turn, and in a blink of an eye, it was gone. At that point, then I could hear, vivid, area sound around me. And the airman that was motionless to the right is beside me, and he is beside himself. He's like all excited. And he says, he thinks he reacquired it. He says, it's over there. This forest is so dark, there's no way you can see anything inside this forest. It was black, I mean, pretty much. And we have a thing called the team concept. You always stick with your team person, your team member. And he thinks he requires it, and he says, it's over there, and he takes off, leaving me no choice but to go after him. So I'm running after him, and we went, go maybe about 50 yards, and there's a double fence. One was barbed wire, by the way. Of course, I was only 26 years old then. I hopped that fence, and I hopped the second fence, and we're in the farmer's field. I'm chasing the airman, and I think I fell down 2 or 3 times in that farmer's field, and it was sort of soggy, even though it was cold out and freezing. So I was wet then. And we get down past the farmers' houses and stuff on the other side of the field, and finally he stops. So here we are out in the middle of nowhere in a clearing. And I go, "What are you chasing?" He goes, "I'm chasing that light." I said, "What light?" And he points in the opposite direction. To my left, and I said, "Where?" And he says, "Over there." And I said, "Where?" He said, "Look down my arm." So I looked down his arm, and way in the distance on the coastline there, about 3 miles away, is a dim light on the lighthouse. I said, "That's not it. That's the lighthouse." And then while I'm sitting ready to get to chew his butt, because I just ran about half a mile, I see it up, the craft's just sitting motionless over the canopy of the forest over by Cape of Green, which still runs from forest area. And it's just there. And I'm going to go ahead and pursue it. And before I could even take any effort to do that, it just started moving very slowly, maybe a few hundred miles an hour toward the coastline, and disappeared. Immediately once that happened, I hear security control contacting me on the radio. And so I said, security's A-okay, I'm okay, all the stuff, And they said, go ahead and proceed back to the base, and we'll come back to CSC, we want to debrief you. Okay. So that's what we did. Get back to the base. The law enforcement guy goes with the law enforcement people. They transport him. I go with the security guys, and we're in a metro, and we're going the back way to Bentwaters. And, so I'm finishing up my notebook in there. I'm converting my times to military time and writing down information, because I got to do a 1569. I know that. That's an incident and complaint report. Besides the blotter entry, the it's a short entry that's in the blotter saying you know off base lights and stuff like that. The 1569 is in detail. It can be a page long typed. It can be 2 pages long. It's a lot of detail. So I wrote down stuff for that, the times and that. The rest of the stuff I can recall from memory. We get the central security control. And I meet Sergeant Chandler. I said, Sergeant Chandler, you wouldn't believe what happened out there. He goes, well, I was at these gates. I seen it all. He says, just go turn your weapon in there. He said, I don't know what to say. He didn't know what to say either. And I said, okay. And I turned my weapon in. I went to CSC, Central Security Control. And I'm getting ready to do the 1569 with Sergeant Coffey. And I said, Sergeant Coffey, about 1569. He says, I got it done. I said, you got it done? He goes, yeah. I said, well, how do you know what the times in that? And he says, we heard you. He said, you kept transmitting. We heard everything on the radio. I go, oh. And so I read the 1569. It was accurate. I says, hey, thanks a lot, Sergeant Coffey. Good to go. Then when I left there, I run into the law enforcement airman, and I says, here, come in with me. I got to go report into the shift commander's office, day shift commander. Lieutenant Buran had to leave early. He had a flight back to the States. He was going on leave. So I met with Captain Verano. He's the day flight commander. Went in, gave him a sanitized report. Said, seeing objects in the woods and multiple color lights. It was metal and kept it pretty generic, mainly because there's just no way that that was going to do my career any good at all. So,
right.
Yeah, it'd be a career ender. So I coined the phrase craft to unknown origin. Because I sure the hell wasn't going to call the UFO. And that's what I call it. And anyway, the captain says, gentlemen, he says, there's no way to report this. He says, Project Blue Book ended in 69. And he says, we have no way to report this. He says, tell you what, he says, I just want you guys to go home, take it easy, and let us take care of it. That sounds good to me. Salute him, left. At that time, I was going to give the Aaron a ride home. He lived in Ipswich, too. We lived about 20 miles away. And I said, I got a couple of things to do. So I had to go. I had dropped the film off at the base photo lab. I did that. Did a work order on it. The airman says, hey, we got to go back out there. I says, no, we're not going back out there. He says, yeah, he said, well, we got to sit in the daylight. And I says, okay. And finally, he was persistent. I said, okay, we'll do that. We went out there and we got to the general area. And he started hollering and he told me to come over. He says, come over here. And it was the area where the craft landed. When we got there, there was the 3 indentions in the ground. And he says, look, he says, there's left indentions. So I says, yeah. I said, we need to get the hell out of here, right? So on the way back in, and we left there. I went home. I was just too traumatized and too hyped up. I couldn't go to sleep. So I went to a friend of mine's house that was, he's a interior decorator anyway. And I says, what would be the best way to take impressions of the ground? He said, I can mix you up some plaster of Paris and you can, it's okay. So that's what he did. So I get my backpack and stuff and I go back out there, go to the landing site, pour the plaster cast. At that time, I smoked cigarettes, so I think it was 3 or 4 cigarettes I had. And there's finally, even though they're moist, I pulled them up and I put them in my backpack because I really wanted to have something tangible from the incident. And that's why I did that. On the way back in, who do I run into but the Deputy Squadron Commander, Major Drury. I run into the day flight chief, Sergeant Gullius. I run into Captain Verano, who told me to go home. And I thought I was going to be in, you know, trouble there. And Major Drury comes up and says, "What are you doing on here?" So I just wanted to check it out again, you know. He says, "Listen," he says, "so we're handling this." He says, "You go back and you spend, take your 3 days off and enjoy it." He says, "Don't worry about this." And so that's where we left it.
You then started, I guess, seeing visions of these ones and zeros at some point.
Right. So I tried to go and get some sleep. Maybe, you know, I got an hour or something. I kept seeing these ones and zeros. So anyway, finally, I mean, this is all during the day shift, the morning after, the afternoon after. I can't go to sleep. I finally get to bed around 11 o'clock at night. So then I have that problem. I can't sleep. I've seen these ones and zeros. And I'm really concerned because I think the trauma, I know it's trauma. And I think I'm losing my mind at that point in time. And I'm concerned because I can't go to the base clinic. I can't go up there and say, I'm seeing ones and zeros. And I had a experience for the craft unknown origin earlier that day. It sounds crazy. I mean, they were going to, you know, probably relieve me of duty and, you know, end my Air Force career and everything else. So that wasn't an option. I couldn't go on the base with it. So anyway, I was going to struggle through the night. And so I get up, can't sleep anyway. So what do? I said, I'll make a pot of coffee. Can't sleep anyway. And then I looked at the casts. I went over and I got my notebook off the table, and I started to look through it, looking at my notes. I mean, all was okay, but the hard thing was these ones and zeros. And I said, you know, I'm flipping through the notebook. And I said, you know, I think I can write them down. And so I find a pen. And I flipped to the, like, you know, the middle of the end of the notebook. It was the only paper I had. And in my mind's eye, I could close it and I could see, you know, this, you know, the 00111010001. I could see them. So I started writing them down. And the odd thing was, when I started to do that, the more I wrote, the better I felt. And as a matter of fact, the pen I had, you know, see how it is, you grab a pen off a drawer, it doesn't always work very well. Well, this one didn't work. And I started panicking, so I'm tearing through the drawer, trying to find a pen that works. I find another pen that works, and I continue to go ahead where I left off and write this ones and zeros back down. I go until, I don't know, I write, and notebook's not that big, but I wrote down, like, you know, like 16 pages of them. And I get toward the end, and all of a sudden I don't see the ones and zeros no more. And I can't write anymore. And I stop, and I feel pretty damn good. And I said, whoa, I'm not even dodged a bullet here. I don't think I'll have to go to the base. I think I'm going to be all right. Well, it's good. The proof's in the pudding. If I can go to sleep, I'll probably be okay. And mind you, I had a half pot of coffee too. And wow. I go to bed and I slept, you know, like till, you know, about 10 hours. But so that's the reason why I never talked about the ones and zeros anymore, because it was a mental breakdown, I thought. And, you know, it was pretty private. I mean, I wasn't going to tell anybody. And I felt okay the next day, so why should I?
Right.
But
eventually it came up again, right?
It came up because somebody else discovered it. Tell you what, we were doing a film shoot in 2010 out at Phoenix. And it was with, I'll tell you who it was with. It was for Prometheus Pictures, the guys that do Ancient Aliens.
Yeah.
And yeah. And there was Linda Moulton Howe. She's doing interview too. And then John Burroughs, the law enforcement guy, was with me. Anyway, I was in that time when they filmed, they actually had film. They didn't do, you know, they didn't have digital stuff. So I'm sitting there getting filmed and they're doing a film. They're replenishing the film on the camera. And so I had a little break there sitting there. And so Burroughs asked me about a time. And I said, oh, I don't know. So I started flipping through the notebook. And I flipped back too far where the ones and zeros were at. And I went, oh, geez, that's too far. And they go, well, what's that? I go, oh, that's nothing. And they go, and I figured, oh, what the hell? Okay, here it is 30 years later, but I might as well go ahead and tell them. You know, I had a little bit of a mental breakdown there that night, and I was all ready to tell them about that. And they said, well, how many pages? And I got quite a few. And anyway, Linda Moulton Howe says, well, the ones and zeros, that's binary code. And I go, what? And it, now, when she said that, I knew the ones and zeros were binary code. And the reason it was fascinating, because I did an interview. I did the hypnosis in 94 because I had a sleep disorder. So I went to my doctor, and she referred me to a psychiatrist. And anyway, so during that hypnosis session, I talk about seeing binary code. And I never knew what the hell that meant. And until I put it together, when Linda Moulton Howe says, well, that's binary code. Oh, no, I wrote down binary code. And they were like kids in a candy shop. They said, well, we got to turn this in. You got to get it deciphered. And you got to see what it means. I said, I think, I mean, that's gibberish. You know, come on. You know, it was a mental breakdown. And we got on with the film shoot. I mean, I got called out on me how many times a day from Linda. She must call me twice a day. She wants to see this or get it analyzed. I says, let me think about it. So anyway, I get a call from Kim Sharon. She's the executive producer, I think, for Prometheus, Ancient Aliens. And she says, we want to do that too. And I said, okay, tell you what I'll do, Kim. I says, I'll scan, like 4 or 5 pages and send them to you. And I says, you're wasting your money on it, I'm pretty sure. And she's going to have an expert look at it. I'm still getting calls from Linda. I still hold her off. I say, yeah, I'm thinking about it. But I don't tell her that Prometheus is is looking at it. About 3 days later, I get a call from Kim. She has me go up online. That's before Skype and all that stuff. But, I could see the emails, and we went through one by one. I says, why are we doing this? She says, now I'm on the phone with her. She says, because the binary says something. I says, there's no way. I says, get out of here. There's no way you can say anything. I says, it can't be coherent. She says, yeah. She says, it's got words and it's got grid coordinates and all. I says, what? And we went through it, and I was like blown away by it. And day,
what was in the message?
In there, it was saying that it's deciphered. What was it? You're gonna make me come off and say it off the top of my head. I'm gonna leave something out.
So you did the best of your. What you can remember about it.
For the exploration of humanity was in there. It had something with the fourth coordinate, whatever the hell that means. Then it had grid coordinates, world global coordinates. There were 7 of them. One was the first one, and the last one were the same, though. Okay. And so I sent it off to, I sent her off a few pages to Linda because she was bothering me every day. And I said, okay, go ahead and have somebody look at it. So she had somebody, a professor, look at it and Australia and one in North Carolina or South Carolina. And a couple of days later, I get a call from her, and she's excited, of course. And she said, it says something. I said, okay, tell me what it says. And she goes through, and it was exactly what Prometheus' interpretation was. I said, oh. And she says, well, you're not very excited. I said, well, I'm perplexed about it. But I said, Prometheus already decoded it, you know, translated it. And she wasn't really happy about that. I'm going to tell you that. she was not happy.
I can't imagine. Why.
I have no idea. I don't know why. I guess, I don't know what, why. I have no idea. And
Did anyone do any further research into the possible meaning of these coordinates or message?
Yes, we're up to that now. I tell you what, back in 2010, we did that first book with Nick Pope. And that was a mess, by the way, about half of us right. Not Nick's fault. It's just we were under deadlines to get it out and from the publisher. And anyway, it's just a lot of it's just not right. But it has the code in it. It has the pages in it. And at that time, I got people, I formed a Reynolds and Forrest research team with different people from around the world researching it. A couple of the people that had pretty good points, one was like a professor at Cambridge in England who wants to remain anonymous because he gets grants and stuff like that, and he doesn't want to have that affected.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the way this one. Yeah, it's funny how that works, really. They want to do the research, but they don't want to go public with it. So, you know, I understand that. But anyway, I was part of the team. And I also had on the team a person that was referred to me in 2010 called Gary Osborne. And Gary, well, he was an author and a researcher and stuff and with Egypt and things like that. And anyway, the team evolved and they had discoveries. And anyway, it got to the point that the guy that was coming up with the analyzing the global coordinates and their relationships found in there a code within a code. So it's not just the coordinates, it's what they point to and what they break down mathematically to. And that's about as best as I can do with it right now. And that was Gary Osborne that made those discoveries. And so we started in earnest doing research in 2015. At that time, just to let you know, I had like 85 pages that didn't go into the first book I did. We missed a timeline on it's not Nick's fault or nothing like that. And Gary had 50 pages that didn't go in. And so Nick says, you know what you should do? You should write your own book. We said, okay. So that's what we did. And we took Gary's research in it. And the Reynolds and Enigma book is 702 pages. Of that, 300 pages are chapter endnotes, which is research. And he wrote the most spectacular epilogue in there, which is about 50 pages. That is the transition into the book about the meaning of the code. And we're going to do a book two. Matter of fact, it's being written right now by Gary. And it'll be out here. We're looking at this year. And anyway, his discoveries are amazing. And one of the most fascinating things that he found as recently as May of 2019, that in this code is the fine structure constant. This is a something that world, you know, scientists all agree upon in the universe. They have these. For example, we operate, you know, at six digits over in decimal points. Okay, that's where we operate. Our whether it's GPS, whether it's with any type of coding or anything, that's where us as humans operate. And the discovery in May of 2019, Gary discovered that this fine structure constant was in there, and it didn't go over six. Even Carl Sagan said if you found a message that went over seven, they would be pretty smart people, very smart people. But the Reynolds code, the code within the code, went over 13 or 14 digits. So whoever that was not just smart, but very smart. Smart enough for interdimensional travel, things like that. I mean, this is probably like a type 2 civilization it came from. I mean, it's pretty far advanced. Anyway, that's part of the research that is described in the epilogue of the Rendlesham Enigma book. And have you read a copy of that yet?
Yes, and you know we're going to have you back on when that other one comes out. That sounds fascinating.
Or maybe with Gary, because you know what? I'm like on a crayon level with it, and Gary...
Definitely, I'd love that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, because I'm just not... it's his research, you know, and it's just fascinating. I tell you what, every time he called me, when we wrote the Reynolds Enigma book, I mean, it was like 40 hours a week, 30 hours a week on Skype. You know, it was just crazy. And it took almost 5 years. And the other thing, that going back to the Reynolds Enigma book, 85% of that's in that book right now has never been released to the public before. So it was unknown to the public, and most witnesses didn't know it was in there. I just kept it close to the vest. And, you know, I'm aging. And I figured, you know what, it's about time with all this disinformation coming out about Rendlesham and that over the last 39 years. I want to make sure it's straight and what happened. And so I wanted a factual account. And so we rewrote the book. Yes.
I was going to ask, ever since the incident, have you ever had any other experiences, seen any other UFOs, anything paranormal, anything like that?
No, zero. No. I guess I tell you, Chris, I found the one time's enough. It was sufficient. I just face it, you know, 99.9% of everything you see outside in the sky, the lights in the sky, can be explained. It's probably, you know, man-made or natural occurring or whatever. People don't know what they're looking at, usually. But most of it's explainable.
Now, what are your thoughts on what's happening today with the kind of like a UFO craze lately with the TTSA, the Navy pilots being allowed to report the sightings, things like that. What are your thoughts on what's going on there?
Well, TTSA, that's just opportunists. Okay. They're out to make a buck.
Right.
That's all they're doing it for. The Navy pilots, the witnesses like that, they didn't have a need to know. I'll tell you what they seen was classified aircraft or drones. That's what they seen. And if you stop and think about that, the whole incident that those people are talking about, that was a naval exercise in a naval exercise area. And one of our theories is that these craft was from Skunk Works was being tested there. That's all. And so they just misidentify with, because they don't know what they see. And it's not to say that the people that witness it are not telling the truth or nothing like that, because I'm sure they are. It's just that they just don't know what they don't know what it is, you know. And some of the theories we have on it are going to come to light, I think, pretty soon. We have the backing of theoretical scientists, you know, like Jack Safardi and stuff like that. If they're not ours, the scary things is it means that they're probably a bad actor nation, you know, and that would be worse yet, like China or something like that. But hopefully they're ours that way, you know, a classified system.
Well, do you think that we are reverse engineering possible off-world technology?
No, I tell you what, one thing I never said with Rendlesham, I never used the term alien or nothing like that, because I don't believe in that. I mean, it's just not true. I mean, I don't see no evidence for it, zero. My thoughts And impressions from the Rendlesham incident is that these are interdimensional travel is being done. And we can use a Hollywood term, if you like, called time travel, right? That's Hollywood. But that's interdimensional travel. And these people, they're responsible for that craft, or we believe, it's our working theory, that they're from our future. And the reason we say that is during that hypnosis session is one of the things that is in the hypnosis session. It's all on tape, by the way. I have 4 hours of it. It says that even in the future, they're still waiting for first contact. So there is, for me, zero evidence of any type of extraterrestrial encounters.
Very interesting.
That's the secret. That's what it says in the book. The secret in the biggest secret in the book is the false flag is UFOs and aliens and all this other stuff. That's the false flag. What they're covering up is us. It's future us. It's us from the future. And that is. Can you imagine to gain that technology? What you could do, you control the world, couldn't you? Power, absolute power.
You know, that's a fascinating theory. I was talking to someone the other day. Dr. Bruce Goldberg, I believe, thinks the same thing, that these are time travelers coming back to visit us. That is a fascinating theory, too.
It is. But the evidence is pointing... Excuse me. The evidence is pointing strictly to that. And I'm not the only one. McMaster's our master's, the professor from Montana, he believes it too, based on his evidence that he's encountered throughout history. And also the evidence that we found that with the code, I mean, this, you stop and think that the only way that this code within the code can happen, as a matter of fact, it goes down to the inch on a global scale. Within an inch on a global scale. I mean, this is how precise it is. And so it's our working theory that we believe that they've been coming for years, and maybe, back to the pyramids, who built them, where did they get the knowledge? I mean, it all makes sense. But Jack Safari, also the professor from San Francisco up there at Stanford, he believes that this is the probably the most likely answer to it. Now, as far as wreckage, it's doubtful. If you can do interdimensional travel, time travel, even if you had a crash, you can go, change it day before? Who knows, If there is any... This is another theory they have. And if you're finding any kind of wreckage, it's because they want you to find it. Okay? And it's not to help us, it's to help them whenever in the future. It's not for us. So, and this is, I think, what they're maybe trying to, if there ever is a thing called disclosure, which I doubt it, have some type of acceptance to this somewhere in the future, because it seems like there's more of these type of unexplainable events like this happening. The other thing, the other theory I heard, you got people that, got these grays and stuff like that. They see them. They're probably manufacturing a hybrid, something, because the interdimensional travel is our theory.
I was
theory
just that, about to ask you about the grays, if they were some kind of biological robots.
Yeah, it's just too traumatic to be able to take corporeal life through. So you have to have a special entity to do that. So they manufacture one, no doubt. That is our theory on it, and that's what could possibly be explained by some, that's what they're seeing. The other thing is in the book, with the Rockford Colloquium chapter, I talk about, you know, meeting with Dr. Green. You know, he says former CIA. You know, is anybody ever former CIA? I don't know. That was just a few years ago. They have a group of 8 or 9 scientists working on it. This is his words. It's in the book. And he believes that the defense system on these craft, this phenomena, can play with whatever you have preconceived notions with mentally. So if you have preconceived notions of aliens and things like that, you're probably going to see them. Closer you get to the craft, and this is the reason why he wanted to meet with me. He figures that if you get within like maybe 20 feet of the craft, you see it for what it is. It's whether it's by the design of its own, you know, maybe they for them to work on it or whatever it is. But if you get actual contact with the craft, like within 5-10 feet of it, you're going to see it for what it is. And that's his theory, not mine. That's what his working group is doing. And that's one of the reasons he contacted us. There was like 50 people he had contacted. And the two that he wanted to talk to was the airman with me and myself, because we had, close proximity to the craft. Myself, actual contact. And so that was one of the reasons why he wanted to set up a meeting with me, which he did. And I described it in the book. So.
Now, as a final question before we close out tonight, do you think that the highest levels of the military is already aware that these possibly could be time travelers?
I believe they're... All right, do you know about unacknowledged special access programs?
Yes, I mean, I've...
Okay, we got tons of them. We got special access programs, nuclear weapons, classified programs, blah, 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 blah. That's all stuff that you can do a FOIA on and get an answer, okay? But then if they take that special access program and they go ahead farming out to civilians, or it's a civilian contractor, it becomes an unacknowledged special access program. And do you know you can't even get a FOIA request on that? It doesn't exist. It's black. So to say that... certain people in the military know, there is a certain section of our government that definitely know what it is. And that is why we have all these, I think them trying to mislead the public with a lot of this UFO information or ufologists. I think that's part of the problem, at least for the last 80 years.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think they do feed a lot of misinformation into the UFO community and researchers along those lines.
Oh, they're loving it. Looking at Blue Book, the television show. You think that there's anything classified? That's all unclassified stuff that for disinformation anyway. You know, and the classified stuff, if there is anything, it's still classified. You're not going to know about it. I mean, they feed into the frenzy, and that's what you're seeing. Will the information come out? I think it'll have to, because I think that it's not under their full control. You know, they'd like it to be, but it's not. So.
Yeah, I'd hope so. And Jim, thank you so much for coming on tonight. Fascinating story. We're going to definitely have to have you back on when the next book comes out. And if anyone wants to get the book, it's on Amazon, right?
Amazon.com. You can get it by Kindle, or you can get the paperback, which is huge, on Amazon.com. And it's available in just about any country in the world.
Very good. Jim, thank you so much, and we'll have you back on soon. You have an excellent night.
Take care, Chris.